The next speaker of this morning is Gerard Hall. He is Associate Professor of Theology at Australian Catholic University. The title of his presentation and speech will be The Evolving Interreligious Vision of Raymond Panica.
Well, welcome back, everybody. I think we all needed that after that very profound presentation and equally profound discussion that took us in so many different directions. Now, the title of this paper is actually The Evolving, it tells you there, doesn't it? It's supposed to be The Evolving Interreligious Vision of Raymond Panikkar, I think, but anyhow, something like that. Because when I thought about this conference, I thought, well, you know, you have to do something a little different every time. What I might do is go back and reread the dissertation I wrote on Panikkar some 20 plus years ago, mainly because I was interested in this question of, well, how did he get there? I mean, I was always much more interested in his more contemporary expressions and the whole cosmotheandric vision, the radical trinity and the end of history, etc. So I just thought, well, it is good to ask, we always ask this really, like, this person has all these ideas, well, where do they come from? And in a certain sense, I'm not going to present a biography. I believe there is a biography on Panikkar. I don't even know of that. But Panikkar himself used to say, look, the personal details of his story are fairly unimportant. And in a way, of course, that's true. But a kind of a general narrative, which again is artificial, but I'll put in four phases. And it just might help a little systematization in terms of the historical development of ideas. And because of the time factor, I'm just going to start at the end rather than the beginning, in the sense of just, I won't get to this quote otherwise. I just think this is one of the most marvellous quotes. It's one of the first quotes I read of Panikkar as a young student in Washington under Scott Eastham. And he gave us this article to read, Man as a Ritual Being. And even I wasn't sensitive to inclusive language issues at that point. But anyhow, it's this most wonderful, wonderful quote, I think. I think it kind of situates what we're dealing with in what Panikkar himself is dealing with and his response to the situation. Once upon a time, he says, there was a man. The man had lived consciously for millennia. He had outlived his history. And all the data and riches of the world at his disposal, but he seemed to have no hope. Though he was educated and well-fed, millions were starving, victims of injustice. The man felt troubled, uncertain. A future for him seemed unlikely to be bearable. His present he found quite uninhabitable, and his past he knew to be lost to him irretrievably. He had constructed an entire worldview, which some call ideology. He had thought about everything. He thought all unthinkable things and found the impotence of reason along with his need for it. He could demonstrate the existence of God and could equally invalidate every proof. He could think of life as meaningful, but he could equally find arguments in favor of its meaninglessness. He could imagine technology solving all the problems. And he could, by the same token, show technology to be the greatest blight ever to affect human existence. He began to surmise that what are called freedom and democracy are nothing but the expressions of the human despair of truth. His head grew tired and his thinking aimless. He began to fear that one thing might do as well as another, provided he never examined the extreme consequences of anything. Then, exhausted, he began to look for an icon, to sing, to dance, to gesticulate, and even something like an inarticulate prayer went up from his body. Soon enough, he went to sleep, or died, or was annihilated by forces beyond his control. Nobody remarked his passing, and yet something had happened. End of quote. And I suppose this puts it in the the context is this question has arisen in the last conversation we're having. We're facing annihilation. We are at the profound crisis point in the history of civilization, of the world, of the universe. And that, in a sense, I think is Pinnacle's starting point, because he too, at least, he's less than 20 years of age when he's living in Spain and he's dealing with the lead up and then the eventual revolution here in Spain. And Franco, meanwhile, he goes to Germany, World War II breaks out. You know, he's living with that reality. So he's known the questions that we're asking today at an earlier stage, a few decades ago, yes, but in a sense the same deep questions. And he perceived, as I think we recognise, that this is not just yet another kind of crisis point, but it's a fundamental invitation to a total turning, as he used to say, of mind, heart and spirit. And unless this occurs, well, then the very negative kind of foretelling critiques of the future may well emerge. The question of optimism and pessimism, I remember him saying too, that's not the question. The question is hope. And hope is a transcendental quality. It's the dimension of the divine within us. The future also is one that we optimism and pessimism are about the human kind of merely human attitudes. We must have a bigger vision. So let's begin here somewhere. So basically, these are the four kind of periods. Now, again, did Pinnacle's views change? Well, of course they did. There's a wonderful quote of John Henry Newman: "In a higher world, it is otherwise, but here below, to live is to change, and to be perfect is to have changed often." And as we know, growth is a very fundamental category for Raymond. It's his understanding of persons, but also of religions themselves, as a very central category. To be human, to be religious, is to grow and to change. And while there's always a profound dimension of continuity, there's also increasingly, as Pinnacle's goes through the various phases, there's more emphasis on mutation and revolution, perhaps, rather than evolution in certain ways. And yet there's always the continuation as well. So they're the four kind of periods, and we'll just have to deal with them fairly briefly each. But you try to put it make it simple into decades. Encounter with modernity. Well, I've got 40s and 50s. Encounter with the East, 50s and 60s. Well, he kind of goes to India the first time, it was 1954, I think. But he was also writing, he wrote a letter in 1949, a little booklet on India. So he was dealing with the question of his Asian roots himself well before he's even actually gone there. He's encountered with the secular world. Well, you could say that perhaps Spain in the 1940s and 50s had already become somewhat secular, but he really confronts that world when he goes to the United States in the middle of the 60s. And of course, all these encounters keep on going on. And then the ongoing integration of his latter years. That's where we're going. So, that the movement then is, I'm not suggesting this is sort of the development of thought. It's less what I've developed than the depthing of experience and corresponding expansion of horizons. Ideas spiral, which is a term he often used. They emerge and re-emerge, taking on new meaning and different forms according to particular pluralistic and existential challenges. So I won't go into all the kind of the, you said the cosmological testament in one sense is a very central dimension of his science philosophy work that is actually happens in Madrid in 1958, but he's already doing science in the 30s in at the University of Bonn under Heisenberg, for example. So he was also writing many of the things that are eventually come out in this thesis in the later 40s and very early 50s. So I'm going to start with the cosmological kind of idea, even though in terms of writings that emerge later 40s into the 50s, etc. We could also call this the whole phase as a Catholic phase. It's somewhere along the line, as most or some know, anyhow, he became member of Opus Dei. It was through that he was ordained a priest in 1946. He obviously comes from a dual kind of religious family, and yet his identification at that point is very firmly kind of from the Catholic perspective and trying to work things out from there. But he's also equally trying to deal with, and it's not only a Catholic perspective, it's a post-medieval kind of Catholic world that he's trying to bring into dialogue with the post-Enlightenment world of modernity in this context of the Spanish Civil War and World War II. Has parallels with the Spanish philosopher Ortego, who wants to move to a post-Christian culture. An interesting thing to do, Joseph, who might be doing this at some point, we talked about this, doing an intellectual history of Panikkar and the influences that have, well, I'll just mention a few people along the way, but Ortega is a very important philosopher, I think, in terms of his philosophy of vitalism that Panikkar kind of takes up, I would suggest, and yet he opposes Ortega because Ortega wants to move to a post-Christian culture. Panikkar is concerned rather to come to a transformed Christian culture according to a interdisciplinary perspective. For those who don't know, I have sort of divided this into the three sections because he did eventually three doctorates in each of these areas in science, philosophy, and theology. So, and yet each of these approaches is very evidently interdisciplinary. So what he calls the cosmological testament, the important thing that he develops and that we know is spoken of in the last day and today, which is the whole idea of ontonomy. And he's looking at this in terms of basically a philosophy of science and even a theology of science. But science and philosophy, for example, one isn't sort of head of the other. One doesn't serve the other. Rather, they should exist in interdependence. So neither heteronomy, where science serves philosophy, nor autonomy, science breaks the shackles, if you like, with philosophy, but genuine interdependence. We need to cross the Rubicon between philosophy and science. Philosophy emphasizes the unitary nature of reality, and science its multiplicity. And yet he says there is another dimension, the dimension of transcendence that neither philosophy nor science can deal with, and therefore we need, well, theology is the way he's speaking. This is the 1940s, 1950s Panikkar. He's saying, like in the 1940s, reality is one and multiple at the same time. He's saying in the 1940s, the Christian Trinity is the fundamental paradigm and ultimate mystery for understanding every reality, divine and non-divine. He's also saying at this time, there's a need for a diversity of methods according to distinct but ultimately related dimensions of reality. We've seen from Francis yesterday that he becomes very critical of science. Talks about the perversity of science. But in this period, I'd say he's a bit more mellow. He certainly wants to critique science's universalist pretensions, and yet he wants, the church, Christianity, to accept the insights of science. So he looks, for example, at entropy, which is the running down universe, the second law of thermodynamics, is it not? So the universe is guided, he says, by material, natural, and transcendent processes. And so we might, for example, I was thinking about this in terms of the discussion that Paolo raised. Look, it seems that entropy, we're in a situation of entropy in our universe right now and global warming, et cetera, et cetera, and it's pretty inevitable. We're just going to be annihilated. But to this Penacaraway says, well, there are other dimensions. There's something indeterminate, unpredictable, immeasurable, transcendent in the cosmos that science can't put its finger on, but from another perspective we can recognize. So he's not taking the law of entropy sort of to task in itself, but he's just saying it's not an ultimate principle. It can't actually describe every reality. When he looks at matter, of course, he studied under Heisenberg in Germany. So the principle of the indeterminacy that demonstrates that matter is something other than passive, inert, scientifically determinable and measurable. Of course, Heisenberg and that crowd, like as soon as you measure something, you change it, all that kind of thing. So there's something unknown and to a certain extent unknowable in matter itself. Also, at this time, in the 1940s again, I know, he spoke of the elemental rhythm in nature, the immeasurable natural rhythm. So it's just amazing to me to go back, which was in the last sort of few weeks, to read this and to realise how much of the language and even the central ideas that are so much part and parcel of the rhythm of being, like his final major wonderful work, in a sense, even before he's really dealt with very, very much, just at the academic discipline level. He deals with space and time. He speaks there also the elemental rhythm in nature. And nature and the cosmos. Nature is a principle of movement and becoming. And this is affirmed, and this is what he's always doing, not only by the physical sciences today, but also by Aristotelian metaphysics. But we also need a theological vision of science that seeks to trace the mediations of God in the natural world. Neither purely immanent pantheistic God nor God who is absolutely transcendent. He speaks at this stage of God as absolute being. He moves a little from that, as well, we will see either with me or with Michiko or the other paper this afternoon, I think. Neither multiplicity nor unity is ultimate, or both are ultimate at the same time. So there is a need for another discipline. His ultimate object is the mystery of being God. Anthropology. I think no one's described the end of modernity better than, in a more cryptic way than this. The modernity, says Penacar, writing in the 1940s, 50s, is the loss of God at the end of the Middle Ages, the loss of self at the Enlightenment, and the loss of the cosmic rhythm, the advent of technology. So there's a radical reversal of the classical experience of the relationality of all things due to the misassumption of philosophy that now everything is explicable to the rational and inquiring mind and to the fragmentation of knowledge among the scientific disciplines. So what we need is, using this expression already in this period, a new innocence. He refers also to the classic notion of microcosm, and he specifically addresses the problem of dualism. In Christian theology, he blames Augustine a little bit for the nature-grace dualism. And the question, how to understand Christian faith in a manner that is expressed in as opposed to the modern human sciences. Now, I've got the Spanish el sentimiento there because the English translation is sentiment. I mean, he wrote a wonderful piece on Jacobi and the philosophy of senti. I've got to say, See, we don't have an English word. Sentiment is a kind of a shallow feeling. It's in English. I don't know, le sentiment in French. Yeah, sentimental, see? Well, that's not what Pinnicard means. So what does he mean? Well, he means that we need to see things. Look, Descartes, you know, I think, therefore I am. Cogito ergo sum. It was Ortega who said, I am, therefore I think. He turned it round, didn't he? And an Australian Marist actually said, amo ergo sum. I love, therefore I am. I think Pinnicard would have liked that one. But the idea is that he's got the whole emphasis on reason and thinking with Descartes, and then he takes Jacobi's philosophy. Jacobi's philosophy is all about the dimension of feeling, of sentiment, and yet there needs to be a third dimension. This is what he deals with in his kind of anthropology. So neither Descartes nor Jacobi, in a sense, is the resolution, but we need a kind of a third faculty, which is the fusion of knowledge with love. And this is what he terms at this stage supernatural faith. I don't know if the words... Jane Austen wrote a novel called Sense and Sensibility. Maybe sensibility would be an English equivalent. Already now he speaks not of Cosmo, but of theandric experience. Trust in reality, not in the human intellect. Self-transcending faith, trusting in the other, confidence in the communion of all beings. Christian theandrism is the unity of the human and divine in the graced human person, as well as relatedness to creation and to the divine mystery. He's speaking already of the need for eruption of a new order. And again, and he brings this in even in the rhythm of being at different points, the need for what he calls the more feminine mystical dimension versus the more masculine, purely rational kind of humanism. Theandric confidence cannot be artificially constructed on nation states, but only on the earth. He deals with, for example, the whole thing of nation building, patriotism, which is kind of, in the time that he's writing, of course, is becoming a significant issue. And then the divine presence, he is working out of a very, what you might say, classical orthodox kind of Christology and ecclesiology. Christ is the center of the universe, and the church is necessary for salvation, but he rejects the dualistic interpretation of nature and grace, history and transcendence, time and eternity, etc. I remember him a little bit later, but saying, like a lot of Christian theologians, Catholic theologians, I suppose, have spent a lot of time, that was St. Cyprian, wasn't it? Outside the church, there's no salvation. Try to say, well, you know, how can you explain that? Well, you can't really, we didn't really mean that. But Pinnicard says, well, no, of course, it's perfectly wonderful. In fact, it's a tautology, he said. The church is the place in which there is salvation. So, of course, outside the church, there's no salvation. Of course, it's not the institutional church that it came to be interpreted as. But also in this period, look, I'm flipping even by so much stuff here. The Trinitarian symbol is really significant. The Trinity is true symbol of all reality. And he does this with reference to his hermeneutics of nature, which is order, love, and goal of existence, I, thou, it or is, the three persons of every language. The Trinitarian hermeneutics of the cosmos, matter, space, and time, of the human, intelligence, will, sentiment, of the divine, Father, Son, and Spirit. So, and then he's also, because of the time he's dealing with, deals with the hidden God, the disappearance, the eclipse, the darkness of God. And now you might find that, in fact, that appeared first off in a book that was published about 1960 or something, but he actually wrote it in 1946. It's in perhaps a little bit more abbreviated form earlier on. And he speaks of this. And he speaks of it like we're dealing with this question. the disappearance, the eclipse, and the darkness of God is an invitation to the purification of the soul. It's a manifestation, a new manifestation of God's absolute transcendence, the hidden mystery of God. While he puts some blame on rationalism and humanism for that reality, he also says the experience of the void is a new revelatory experience to encourage human freedom and responsibility in the history of divine self-disclosure. So we will probably not get too much past this next, we'll just go as quickly as we can. Right. So, Panikkar eventually goes to India and studies there, and he does various, obviously, an expansion of horizons and a depthing of experience, building on the foundations that he's already laid well before he's confronted systematically the whole Eastern Western kind of thing. He particularly stresses, Francis asked me about that book yesterday, Religion and Religion's Unity and Diversity. I think it was about the end of the 50s or early 60s where he writes that. Yes, early 60s. And he looks at the Western approach to start with, which is prevalent in that book. He talks about the underlying structure and the functional unity of religions. He speaks of a theandric anthropology as necessary, that is present in one way or another in all religious traditions, as he understands it. That the human being is dynamic, temporal, individual, social, etc. All religions, including the Christian religion, need to undergo change, growth, conversion, significance, also in this sense of diversity. And he comes up at this time with the idea of different religions being the different prisms of the rainbow, the different colours of the rainbow. But he's more taken, I suppose, by the philosophy of India at this point, and the whole thing of the principle of identity versus the principle of non-contradiction. And that wonderful quote, that truth is not something that we possess, but something that possesses us and besets us, something in which we find our being, unquote. So truth comes not only from genuine objectivity, but also from authentic subjectivity. Christ, the meeting ground. Well, his first, systematic work, well, rather after his doctoral dissertation and emanating from that, is his Unknown Christ of Hinduism in the 1964 edition. Where religions, he talks about the existential encounter between Christianity and Hinduism. The meeting is not in doctrine, but in faith. Christ, he also says, does not belong to Christianity, but Christ is also the ontological goal, the true inspirer, and the hidden presence within Hinduism, etc. So, look, I won't actually go too much into that, but I suppose I'm suggesting that there is, I can see, if you like, something of a shift between his 1964 and his 1981 when he re-edits that volume. A shift, I think, from focusing less in the latter work on objectivity than the subjective kind of dimension of experience. And we're talking a lot about dialogue. I remember Bernard Lonergan, and this applies so much to a lot of Panikkar's later work, he talks about the importance of logical dialogue, where human beings relate to one another as subjects, as distinct from dialectical dialogue, which treats human beings as objects. Because Panikkar's whole kind of approach to dialogue is very much the former, is it not? While recognizing always, and he did say much earlier on, the importance of the reason always has the veto power. Like, it's never irrational. He's not suggesting an irrationality at any point, but just that the pathway to knowledge and truth and freedom and love always is requires something much more than human reason. The Trinitarian spirituality, which of course is developed and radicalized, it is the cosmotheandric experience to the rhythm of being, is of course developed in this phase already from the mid-60s with the Trinity and the religious experience of man, and most of you will at least know of that somewhat. But what's most significant is I suppose the way that he does a whole Trinitarian reading of the religions of the world. And someone like Rowan, the former Archbishop in England, Williams, said, look, this will turn out to be one of the most significant theological texts of the 20th century, just that little book. So while other people will dismiss it, oh, how can you deal with all the religions of the world and put them all into little boxes or whatever, there's something else going on there that's quite profound, and then it certainly has an incredible impact upon the development of his thought, and also on development of many, many other thinkers, East and West. I'd like to just perhaps, though, focus here on the silence of God and the possibility of interreligious dialogue between theistic and non-theistic traditions. And the way that Penekar moves increasingly to be aware of the importance of not only the God's being, but as he says, also God's non-being, which itself connects to what he calls the atheistic dimension of religious faith. He talks, of course, in terms of the dealing with the Christian-Buddhist dialogue of the Buddha's or the apophatic stance. And yet, at the existential level, so much that is in common that you'd think immediately, of course, would not be so. But Buddhism and Christianity both stress renunciation of the self, mystical experience, and orthopraxis. Then he talks about the problem of Western theology, in a sense, or the West's progressive divinization of being, which is the total identification of God and being. On the positive side, it frees the divine from limited identification with tribal religions. It overcomes the dualism of the divine human, faith, reason, matter, spirit, sacred and profane, because being is God most high, reality is one, and the world is a cosmos. And on the negative side, the person dealing with the whole thing of the divinization of being is how to deal with the personal character of the divine and the whole question of evil in relation to the divine, the theodicy problem. So his resolution is, he said, we need to turn to God's non-being, even if this is yet to be traversed by the modern Western world. He critiques atheism's, what he calls, over-hasty denial of God, yet sees herein the possibility of the purification of the concept of God, who is both being and non-being, or beyond both being and non-being. And so he's dealing now with the whole apophatic attitude, and this is 1960s into the 70s. And then we won't deal too much with this because Francis has done with it yesterday, but he's invents the phrase, of course, of sacred secularity that shows a certain sort of, a positive affirmation of aspects of secularism, and yet, of course, the negative side that we've heard already about. Technology and time, chronos time, technology destroys harmony between the human and natural worlds. It imposes its own diachronic rhythm. And machines save time but make humans slaves to time. Technology confronts humanity with the abyss of the end time, and so has a spiritual implication, the dark night of the soul, makes us nomads again in space and time. It may be an agent of spirituality and redemption by forcing us to take space and time seriously, while also revealing the world's fundamental contingency. We cannot build here an everlasting city. The sacred secularity is a new experience of space and time in which the world is made real, ultimate, sacred, and temporal. Being itself retreats from the notion of God beyond time and history. The classical approach was to treat God as being beyond time and history. Through the experience of secularization, we need to experience God in time and history. And this can be done in both theistic and non-theistic ways. So it becomes a kind of an avenue for him to continue following his dialogue with Buddhism, for example, especially, and then a dialogue with the atheistic dimension or the atheistic belief in the or non-belief. The Christ symbol is open to pluralism, and he talks already the radical relativity of interpretations. Secularism need not be a rejection of the sacred, but a new appreciation of the sacred in time and history, etc. Also, in terms of ritual, the three types of ritual, the three, he talks about ritual and transcendence. In the theocentric universe, the sacred is separate from the world, and worship and rituals designed to transplant humans to this other realm. And so for the classic consciousness, secularization is a great shock. Autonomy, which is the anthropocosmic kind of universe, where human work becomes worship and sacrifice. And of course, this, in other words, sacrifice continues on even into the secular world. But of course, what he is promoting is the approach of autonomy, living in a cosmotheandric universe, of tempeternity, etc. While neither relegating the sacred to another world or idolizing this one. The importance of freedom and religion. Religion once used to be all about, in a more classic consciousness, all about duty and obligation. But now, if religion is to have any meaning or significance, it needs to embrace authenticity, freedom, and human subjectivity as absolutely important to the dignity of the human person and to what religion therefore should be. So the free act becomes the religious act. And then he goes back to all the traditions and sort of demonstrates, both East and West, at least in Christianity, Hinduism, Buddhism, that in fact the dimensions of freedom and dignity are very profoundly real in those traditions. And so always with Penekar, there's this sort of profound moving into a whole new kind of consciousness, and yet through the dialogue with other traditions, religious and otherwise, we in fact recover dimensions of our own traditions that have been lost. I'm sure I've gone well over any time I should have done. And the next piece, obviously, is, in a sense, what most of the conference is on, which is the Penekar in the last three decades, I'd say, three or four decades. But just to show that through that little kind of historical sort of minuet, that in so many of the ideas that become central are already, they're there not only in seed, but are already little plants at least, and then they grow. In this, there's some change of ideas, there's different emphases, etc. But it is a spiral, and I actually think it's very interesting and quite amazing that some of those ideas, he was only 20 in his 20s when he's already developing them, which I think is really, really incredible. Anyhow, thanks very much.
Thanks for that systematic presentation on Panikkar's development of his thought and so on. And thanks for that. How do you look at the transformation of Panikkar from the background of the idea or concept of Advaita? How does that affected him, and how does the concept of Advaita transformed him in his second stage view you indicated, or from the second part of the first stage? Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, I really skipped over that, I suppose, which is a bit bad. But obviously, there are people here with much more knowledge and profound knowledge of that reality to speak of that than I can. That it had a profound kind of, I would say, I suppose what I'm suggesting is his understanding of an experience of Advaita confirmed these initial kind of, Trinitarian, non-dual. He was already talking about non-dualism. Perhaps he had already read something about Advaita when he was in Spain in those days. I can't say that he hadn't. But the whole thing of Advaita or a-dualism is something that he already has sort of instinctively in his scientific, philosophical, and anthropological studies, and theological ideas as well. So, obviously, it gives him a whole new language and ability to categories in which to speak, and no doubt he depths it. But all I'm suggesting is that the fundamental kind of instinct was already there.
Gerard, thank you so much. I'm so surprised, for example, the idea of autonomy came out of his dialogue with science in a way. And that is very helpful, and his reaction to Ortega y Gasset, because he's the only Spanish thinker that he would mention in a seminar. And now you're putting everything in the context and reminding us. And it's so important, in a way, to sort out. But you wrote your dissertation on this particular period of Panikkar. Is that what you did?
Well, I did the whole.
Yes, okay. And what was Panikkar's reaction to you? Because he was still alive when your dissertation came out. So I'd like to hear what he said to your work. Because I have a larger question. This is a leading question.
Well, one of the reasons I'm doing this is that I'm a little uncertain. I mean, put it this way, he did decline to write the foreword to the book, if it had happened. I suppose I was dealing with it more specifically from a theological perspective, and when it came to which I skipped over there, but the theology of the Christology and Trinitarian theology, I mean, there's obviously growth in his understanding, the way that he develops that, the cosmotheandry principle, etc. I suppose I suggested that there was change from what I would have called the fulfillment theology of Karl Rahner, for example, to a kind of a theology of mutuality or of pluralism or of cosmotheandrism or whatever. And I think I would do it differently now, but I still think that there is. I think Robert Vachon and I had a conversation around this. Now Robert said, "No, Panikkar did not change," and that's partly why I read that quote of Newman. Well, I mean, Panikkar is all for the whole universe changing and all of us deepening and changing our consciousnesses. And of course, he's human like us, and he changed his. I mean, it's not a problem to me if he changed. The question is, I suppose, did he? Now, the major change is from an emphasis on a more objective kind of way of writing about from a theology to a more emphasis on the subjective experience or the mystical kind of way of writing theology, I suppose. Now, he does that with reference to Christ and the church. Now, he never said to me, look, I don't think you're right there or anything, but I suspect he thought I may not have been. But I don't know. That's the answer.
Yeah, just to come and see if it helps. The problem of dualism, hardly any European theologian deals with. I don't know of any European theologian, Protestant or Catholic, who thematically deals with this problem. But this has been bedeviling Panika right from the beginning, whether it's science or theology or Christianity, or whether it's other religions or Christianity. Whether he found the answer right at the beginning and all that, I leave it aside. But this was a problem that bedeviled his whole thinking. But let's take a book like Worship and Secular Man, one of his earlier books, which is rarely quoted anywhere. But I find it a seminal book, Worship and Secular Man, where towards the end, he had a new logism, where he talks of rubrics and nigrics. Rubrics, we all know, what in our missals was printed in red, and how you were given directions and how to celebrate. And Panika puts the whole thing upside down. He says what is important is not rubrics, but nigrics, the black text. That is telling us what is faith, what is belief, and so on. And secondary are the nigrics, the rubrics, how you have to go about this. Before that, he has spoken about heteronomy, autonomy, and ontonomy. But I see this book really a seminal book where all this problem of dualism comes in. And I have not even once seen this book quoted in my study of Panika. I don't know how to explain this. Because this problem of dualism is throughout Panika. So I don't know how you look at it. Regarding the earlier question, Panika's reaction. You know, my insight into Panika is Panika never reacted. He always responded. Never reacted, whether to church or to politics, but he always took time to respond. That's the thing that I feel we should learn from that. You know, because people expect a response. They need to be guided. I would like a response, not a reaction from you.
Was there a question? I think Francis and I were talking about, somebody may know Shirai Kumalainen. Finnish. Yeah. Do you know him?
Yeah.
Well, he's a very bright person, and he's a evangelical Lutheran, and this is now 10 years old, I think. But he certainly has a wonderful mind, and he reads a pen. He's a wonderful way of writing. But he does what Francis is talking about. Like, in the end, he says, look, what's Panika done? He's come up with a theory about all the world's religions, Yet, so we've got one more theory. It's a theology of religious of the world religions. Basically, it's called the cosmotheandry, whatever. And it's just one more theory, and it's elitist, and you know, a lot of Christians couldn't find themselves in his Christophany anyhow, and he kind of makes all those various critiques. But what is fundamental, and this is one of the problems at the academic level in the Western world, is that they treat Penekar always in terms of the cosmotheandry vision, for example, dualistically, like as a theory. Like, and I suppose what I try to do in my thesis, my very old thesis, was, I mean, Penekar calls it a myth. I reckon it functions as, however, as a symbol, I think. But whatever it is, symbol or myth, it's not a theory. Which also I think is important to say that, like Penekar, in my way of thinking, is not saying that like we need to become kind of Penekar missionaries and go around the world and get them to this cosmotheandric way of speaking. I mean, whether it's the Dalai Lama or so many other people express in far other ways. They're mediators of transformation of consciousness. That's what we need in our world. And I think all of us here probably agree, well, Penekar is certainly right. The person that we perhaps recognise as performing that very important prophetic role. But I can remember Penekar himself at the seminar things. I'd say, like, I don't want everyone to become a Penekarite, you know. He wants everybody to become cosmotheandric and enter into the divine mystery and all that kind of thing. But in the Western Academy, I think, Francis, what you're saying, I mean, I've tried to explain Penekar at different seminars and whatever. I mean, they all like it, like, to a certain extent, but I mean, really, it's a bit woolly, it's a bit mystical, it's not really hard-nosed enough. And that's that dualistic issue that you're kind of raising.
Thank you for your overview of Panica's life and Panica's periods. And I want to apologize in case my question looks too much philological and biographical, but you were right to say at the beginning that he met a lot of people, and I think we can paint a fresco with all the masters and the philosophers and professors that he met during his life. In the last part of my research for my PhD, I started to think that maybe the early phases until 1977 can be divided in two main periods. The first one is tied, can be tied with the teaching of Xavier Zubiri, the philosopher who met while he was still studying here in Spain. And the second period, from 1953 to 1977, maybe we can call it the Roman period due to his relation with Enrico Castelli and the evolution of his thought according to those thematics. It's an idea of mine that I'm trying to formulate and trying to build on the textual occurrence and the evolution of his thinking. What do you think about it? Is it appropriate or maybe not so? Thank you.
Working?
Does it work?
Sorry. I'm fascinated in what you're suggesting. I haven't gone into that kind of intellectual history stuff as such, so I'd be really interested to hear how you do that. We'll talk later. I may not have got to the question properly.
Well,
I was just asking if you thought from your studies of Panikkar, if this segmentation of these early works and this early period of life was coherent with his biography. The first phase, it's until the 1953 when he first moved in Rome, when he studied under Xavier Zubiri. And the second is 1953 to 1977 when Enrico Castelli died. The early part, yes, it's an idea of mine. I still have to correctly formulate it, also because there are some problems in defining, because it's...
It's always going to be a little bit artificial. Like, my divisions are artificial, but... As I say, it's so complex with Panikkar because he's dealing with his Indian religious identity well before he goes to India. He's already writing about it. Then he's dealing with the secular kind of stuff like well before he goes to the United States. But I think that's where he really confronts it in a more systematic fashion. But just like in all our lives, we divide them up, and it's a little bit artificial, but I think any division, if you can justify it according to certain criteria, is fine.
On the earlier point, Francis and Gerard, that you spoke about the question of dualism, I think it is sort of central, and of course it's a very large question that engages him throughout his thinking, dualism, ardualism, non-dualism, and he himself, as you know, changed his sort of thinking along the way. My sense of it, and that's why I certainly appreciated your sort of more developmental approach. I mean, at least in looking at the earlier writings in the 40s and the 50s on the philosophy of science and on the question of autonomy, he has the strong intuition that the West is sort of strongly dualistic, and of course already from the West the thinkers that he's impressed by are Nicholas of Cusa, Eckhart, and so on, who move in a more non-dualistic direction, and he writes about them. But I think it was really his encounter with Swami Abhishektananda and others who gave him the existential sense of what non-dualism means, that this was not just a sort of intellectual construct, which he had already arrived at, I think, in his earlier period. And the book, Worship and Secular Man, it really comes out of, it's one of the earlier fruits of that encounter with Abhishektananda, which is a profound meeting. I think Raimon himself, of course, without calling him his guru, sort of regarded him as his guru, because that was perhaps the most formative influence in his thinking, where this became a very real issue for him as an experiential reality, not just as a kind of intellectual construct. And that book that you cite, which is, I agree with you, one of his extraordinary works, unfortunately, not much written about, but it's one of the early intimations of this change, where non-dualism becomes an experiential reality, and he begins to see more and more, and at that stage, the sort of confrontation with his earlier sort of Western self becomes more and more pronounced, and then of course the ideas of Trinity and so on, it expands, but the kernel, I think, is really in this phase in the 50s and the 60s when Worship and Secular Man is written.
Okay then.